My mic wasn't on. How about that? November 9th. This is, I want to say it's live, but it's not. But I try to do these in one take. So sometimes you forget to turn on the microphone. Okay. November 9th. Welcome to the podcast. This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. I'm your host, Eddie Lindenstein. It is episode 299. That's a lot, folks. So it's been going on since October of 2017, and there will be more on that next week for big episode 300. Before I get started, though, I wanted to make sure that I thank the patrons of the podcast. If you are interested in becoming a Patreon supporter, which are people that are helping keep the lights on for this podcast, and there have been a lot of them through the years, currently a couple dozen. But what I think is most crazy is that Arnie and Barb became patrons 5 years ago next week. How about that? So since 2018, meaning that they have donated to this show every single month since November of 2018. So Arnie and Barb, I thank you both so much for continuing to support the show. Sarah and Brian and Julie and Christina, all from the last decade, from before pre-2020, which is crazy. And then Michael, Tony, Kelly, Irina, Mindy, Jason, John, Dominic, Elise, Emily, Daniel, Deborah, Julie, Jeff, Albert, Teresa, and Mary. Thank you all for supporting the podcast every single week, month, and year. Genuinely means a ton to me. Today's interview is one of the coolest ones that I've done in a while, I feel. It's great to talk to a psychotherapist. This guy's been on my radar for a long time, Dan Lyman. And if you want to know more about him, you can go to mindbodytherapycenter.org. I thought that he was still LA based, but it turns out he's Portland based, which is only a hop, skip, and a jump away from me, 3 hours, south. But it was nice getting some of his perspective, how he got into this, and, some of the gaps that he feels is missing in curriculum when people go to school for psychotherapy. I think stuff like that is really interesting and sort of this evolution over the last 10 years since he got into it. And so a lot of today hovers around that, and it's a little bit of a longer interview. I've tried to keep them around 25 to 35 minutes lately, but this one goes close to an hour. So, but I think you're going to love it. Dan was an absolute treat, and I'm excited for you to hear it. Next week is episode 300. I got a couple interviews booked on my request from last week, which was, hey, if you're a patron, please send me an email. I'd love to interview you for the show. Scotty Styles is coming up here in the little next little bit. Daniel, who I just read off his name as a patron subscriber, he's coming up in a little bit or in the next couple of weeks. But what I want to bestow upon you, if you could, send me a DM or an email, eddie@themindandfitnesspodcast.com. I did this a couple of years ago where I asked for people in the audience to send me over stories or anecdotes or something that they had discussing what they are thankful about in terms of this mind-body odyssey that they've been on themselves. There's a ton that I could say, and I'll say a lot of that stuff over the next couple of weeks as we roll into Thanksgiving here. But ultimately, episode 300 is a big deal. I remember being around episode 90 or 95 and reaching out to people that I had interviewed in that time prior about doing some kind of a big panel show for the big episode 100. And it's hard to believe that that was 4 years ago now that I did that pre-COVID. It's wild. So without further ado, here's Daniel Lyman, LCSW, and I talking all things Mind-Body Therapy Center and what he's doing in the community. Let's listen to Dan and I. Welcome back to the Mind and Fitness Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Eddie Lindenstein. I have a great guest today and somebody who I've sort of been watching on the peripheral for a few years now, but it's Dan Lyman, who is the founder of the Mind-Body Therapy and Coaching Center. Do I have that right?
Yes, that's correct. Yes.
And this, we just learned this. So I found out about you from when you were at, is it the Pain Psychology Center?
Exactly.
In California? Okay.
Yeah.
So I found out about you when you were there several years ago, and then Christy Weepy, who's been on the show a few times, she talks about you too glowingly.
I pay her well for that.
Yeah. Checks in the mail, or Venmo, yeah, exactly. Venmo's in the mail, or whatever right, you want to yeah. say. But I thought that you were a Southern California guy, and then I come to find out that you live 3 hours from me, and that you actually originated 10 miles from me, which is crazy.
Very close. Yes, I actually was grew up in spent that time in Ballard. Awesome. So just not too far.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Ballard is where it's our favorite donut shop is down. We go to Mighty O and the kids love it. And down in the Ballard neighborhood, yeah, we love it down. And actually, my wife lived she lived on 83rd in Greenwood when we met. And then we got married at Golden Gardens, which is in Ballard.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, very cool. Wow. Yeah. Small world. And actually, I need to write this donut shop down because my husband loves donuts so much. He'll freak out next time we go to Seattle.
What's cool is that they're – so here's the thing is like – a good vegan donut is a hard thing to find. And
for sure.
And they're all vegan. And the nice thing is that like they have the sort of thicker cake donuts that usually I would think of as like a vegan donut. Cause a lot of times they're sort of a little, I don't know, harder is not the right word, but like the airy donut that you'd typically get at any other place. A lot of vegan places just don't have that. This place has it, and they have my favorite apple fritter, and just make sure that you make a stop when you get up here.
Definitely an apple fritter. You have me. I'm sold.
Yeah. So first off, it's great to have you on, not just because you're a respected name in this world, but I always talk about how like, hey, there's not a lot of males that I talk to that are therapists that are in this. And I'm trying to think like it's fewer than a full hand, meaning probably just a couple. A lot of the medical doctors are.
Yes.
And I see a lot of them mentioned on your website, and all of them have actually been on the show, the entire team of physicians that you've that are on the website. But as far as male therapists that do specific like mind body pain psychology work are concerned, there's not that many of them. So I would love to start there if you have any perspective on, hey, like, what's the deal? Why is this line of work, or maybe it's this discipline? Like, for instance, teaching. Like my mom and dad, both retired teachers. It took till my daughter was like 6 before she believed that even male teachers even existed. And this is kind of the same thing, you know?
Just one of those professions where it's become like very kind of very gendered for unspecified reasons. In the psychology and therapy world, you know, it used to be a profession dominated by men. We think of a lot of the original theorists in psychology. They were all men.
Mm-hmm.
And then around the 70s and 80s, it really transitioned to being a female-centered profession. And you're right, there aren't a lot of male therapists. There's actually in really high demand right now because people, more and more men are seeking out therapy and they want other male therapists, or they want to work with male therapists.
I do get a fair number of inquiries of people asking for work. A lot of times, like, somebody will send me, here's the deal with, you know, here's kind of what's going on with me, and I'll drop a name or a referral. I hate saying referral because I'm not a doctor or anything like that, but I do talk to a lot of the people in the field.
Okay. You talk to everybody.
Yeah, I talk to everybody. And there are a fair bit of males throughout the year that will ask, hey, like, I'm not gelling with this female or this. It would be really nice to have a male perspective. And so it's nice to have those in the Rolodex, basically.
Yeah, you know, my team is half male, half female right now, and that's on purpose because I want to be able to offer that for men. I do, you know, mental health is underserved for men, weirdly enough. Medical health tends to be underserved for women, or not tends to be, it is. Mm-hmm. So, but I think that's right, we're trying to wrong here. And it is odd being, I'm a white guy, but it's odd being in a minority in a profession here. So I'm like the token male therapist in a lot of spaces.
Yep. Yep. Hey man, I'm on the PTA board for both my daughter's elementary school, and I am the only male. And then I'm also on a board of directors for an HR organization up in Bellingham. And I am also the only man on that. And then I coach an all-girls soccer team. So
there you go. Yeah. You're used to being that minority. Yeah.
Okay. So talk about where you went to school. I know where you went, but talk about where you went to school and kind of what, like, did you go to school with the intent of getting into this line of work? And then we'll go a little deeper and get into, hey, like, you're specifically treating chronic pain. You specialize in the treatment of chronic pain, anxiety, OCD, depression, sexuality, things like that. But who knows if that's why you went to school. So give us the, you know, the Avengers origin story.
Yeah. Oh man, I like thinking of myself as a superhero. That's great. you know, this is actually something I don't talk about with a lot of my clients just because it's not relevant to the work we do, but I had a previous career before I became a therapist. I worked in entertainment. I was living in Los Angeles and I worked in entertainment. I worked as a production designer for TV and film. And I didn't do it for very long, only 5 or 6 years. amongst other things that I was doing. But I honestly was just not feeling satisfied with the work that I was doing. I was volunteering at the time it was called the Gay and Lesbian Center in Los Angeles. And I was volunteering there to doing like one-on-one work with people, kind of like one-on-one, essentially like basic counseling work. I did that a handful of times while I was working in production. And I thought, I enjoy this so much more and it feels so much better. Why don't I do this for my career instead of production? And so I went to University of Southern California to get a master's in social work. And I also got a master's in public administration while I was there. Because I wanted to kind of set myself up for the most success that I could in terms of working in a profession where I was helping people. I kind of like to think of myself as someone who really enjoys and takes great pleasure from helping people on an either micro or macro level. So the Masters of Social Work was on the micro level and the public administration was on the macro level, is kind of helping to enact, you know, legislative change to make things better for people. That was kind of my goal, was to just, maybe it sounds like overly altruistic or kind of like obnoxious, but I just wanted to go to school so I could get a career where I was doing one-on-one service with people, because I really enjoy doing that. My very first class on my very first day of grad school was with a guy named Alan Gordon, and we just kind of hit it off. And so he asked me after... through grad school, I figured out, okay, I want to go into therapy. I want to be working directly with people, which ironically, years later, I went and looked at my eighth grade yearbook, and everybody had their like what they wanted to be at that point. And I had said, I really want to be a therapist.
Wow. So that's awesome.
It had been in my mind for a long time. I think at that point it was just subconscious. But Alan and I kind of hit it off, as I said. And then when he wanted to start the Pain Psychology Center, he said, hey, when you graduate, let's start the center with a group of us. But there were four of us that started it. And so I just went from grad school straight into working in pain, and that was in pain therapy. And it was amazing. I really, like, right from the get-go, I really responded well to it. I loved it. And it just kind of spoke to me on a lot of levels. So,
Do you find, like, maybe this is a tough question to answer, because you did sort of go with you sort of went to school with a idea of, like, getting into pain psychology, or at least after you met Alan.
Right.
What would you say is, like, you know, let's say I go back to school. I know nothing about this. I know nothing about chronic pain being related to emotions or anything like that. But
right.
I do have a passion for psychology or psychotherapy or social work or something that's in that discipline. And I go back to school and I take sort of the general courses. I take general psych, I take social psych, I take human sexuality. I take a lot of these courses because I have enough credit, or I took enough credits in college to have a minor in psychology. There was one course that I would have needed in order to get it, and it would have meant I had to wait an extra quarter, which I just wasn't willing to do.
Yeah, not worth it.
to get a minor, and I just wanted to just finish up. I don't remember ever pain being brought up in any of the courses, and how many years am I removed now? I'm 15 years removed from college, so maybe it was there and I don't remember it, but. Is this something that's even talked about in just general psychology courses, that somebody that wants to be a psychologist not specializing in pain psychology would even learn about?
Absolutely not. It's still not talked about. And I'm only a couple years removed from, like, guest lecturing and stuff at USC. I've kind of taken a break from guest lecturing in graduate school, but I can confidently say it is not talked about, which is something that we are, I hope that we as a field are working on to change. But it's because the science is so new, and because it is still a niche community. It is graduate schools are just not on board yet. You know, most of the education you get in graduate school for psychology is based on a lot of, as I said, kind of like old white guy theorists.
Sure.
Psychologists, and not that there's any problem with what the theories there, but it's old school. It's not as up to date. And there are programs that definitely teach more contemporary psychology, but I don't know of any that are focused on pain or even really have even a minor emphasis on pain psychology.
And if I went and signed up at USC or Stanford or UW or UCLA or whatever, is there even a class or an offering that I can sign up for? Or is it just, there is nothing there in that discipline?
There's nothing there. And I get people reaching out to me about that. And usually I'll say, here are the trainings you can take. Like, take the pain reprocessing therapy training, take the EAET training, emotional awareness and expression training, take ISTDP. I will kind of tell people, you know, gear them towards that, which is, you know, not based on any graduate program, but that's where you really get the education that you need in order to focus on pain.
I don't know if you've heard, I've had him on a couple of times, and I've spoke at the grad school, for, the University of Rochester a couple of times. Dr. Doug Gafrida, he coaches, or he not coaches, he teaches a course on pain psychology. So I know at least it's somewhere.
There's a fiat, and I hear about that, like one course here and there, but I don't know of any programs where that's a sort of focus or anything you could, you know, you could actually actively choose to study regularly.
What was the, when did you actually start getting into that discipline? What year are we talking about that you would have started like seeing, seeing clients to work with on pain psychology specifically?
2009.
Oh, okay.
No. Yeah, around then, maybe. I can't. I honestly don't remember. I'd have to look.
Okay.
I'm kind of bad with dates, but around then.
Well, you look younger than that. I'm not saying you're old, but but I thought this was going to be like a 2015 or 2016. That's where I thought was coming next. So.
No, it was earlier than that. Maybe I'm exaggerating. Maybe it was closer to 2010. But no, it was earlier than that. I've been doing this for over a decade now.
What so there's a lot in like there's a couple of different trains of thought. Not that they're different. I actually think that like one of the issues that seems to happen on like when I see online forums or the TMS Wiki, which is how you and I actually got connected, or whether it's a Facebook group or whatever, it seems like there's sort of a perception that there's a couple of different schools of thought when it comes into this, that it's either kind of that it's kind of in like the Schubiner camp of like, you know, pain reprocessing therapy. And that's kind of what he's talking about versus like the Sarno camp of more oxygen debt and all that kind of stuff. Me being an outsider that has no formal training in any of this, but has read all
spoken
of the books.
Spoken to everyone.
Yeah. Spoken to everybody and read all the books. I think that y'all are saying the same thing, just with different words. Can you talk about that a little bit?
To be clear, Eddie, you have an honorary doctorate in this.
It's funny. The 6-year anniversary of this show happened about 2 weeks ago. So,
oh my gosh,
as we record this, yeah, it's been a long time. It's been a long time.
Yeah, so that's what I mean. You are very well versed in this more than most. I agree with you. We're all saying very similar things. It's just kind of different branches on the same tree. And everyone's, you know, so much of psychology is about theory. And of course, we do rigorous studies to demonstrate whether the theory is applicable or accurate or not. But a lot of most science, most medicine is, you know, theory based, and then we test it. So all of these things that we're all saying, whether it's from the psychologist or the doctors, physicians, whomever, we're all saying various shades of the same thing. And it kind of depends on what your perspective is. I talk to doctors about this a lot. You know, if you're a physician and you see a patient and you see them 2 or 3 times, you're gonna have a very different perspective than a therapist who sees them 50 or 60 times over a year or two. You know, you're gonna have a very different perspective on what's going on, and neither are wrong or neither are right. It's just very different.
Has there been like I guess let's just say that you've been doing this for 15 years. We're close enough, 14 years, whatever. Let's include the school and some of that kind of stuff. How has there been evolution in this particular discipline in that time? Are there a couple of things that jump out at you at all where, hey, like this is either, like, let me give you an example. So I started doing this podcast in late 2017. And prior to that, I don't recall ever seeing anything about mental health being a vessel for physical pain. I just don't remember seeing it. And
it didn't exist 6-7 years ago.
and it could also be one of those things too, where like, if I'm not looking for it, I won't see it. And so that could be part of it. And then I was watching a Seahawks game one day. This was probably in 2019 or maybe 2020. And I think it was Cigna. It was one of the healthcare companies had a ad where they were talking about the importance of mental health, but that mental health could lead to physical symptoms for certain people. And they gave some examples and I was like, what did I just hear? Like,
it was on
Fox Sports. It was a national telecast. And like, I was very surprised to see that. So how have you seen some of this evolution? Cause it had to feel for the first few years, like maybe you're kicking tires or maybe I'm totally wrong about that. But talk about this change between the 2000s, which we could make, we could say you started then, and now we're in the 2020s, and you know, a lot's changed then. But talk about how a lot's changed maybe in this line of work.
Yeah, you're hitting on two things here, which I think are important, is that there has been this massive evolution. The fact that there are so many different, I can speak to the therapy part of it. There are so many different group practices. There are so many different therapists all around the country focusing in on this. It's vastly different than it was 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. I lead the pain reprocessing therapy trainings through the Pain Reprocessing Therapy Center. And those are, 150, 200 people trainings every other month of therapists and physicians and PTs and acupuncturists, et cetera. And so we're talking hundreds of people per year, nearly 1,000 people or over 1,000 people per year that are now trained in this idea. And that's huge. That is it's just mind-blowing to me compared to before. Alan Gordon, probably as a way to like help me feel confident and boost my ego early on, would say, you're one of only 40 or 50 people in the world that is trained in this.
Yeah.
That is absolutely not true anymore.
Yeah.
I'm one of thousands that is trained in this and is aware of this, which is great. It's amazing, but it's changed dramatically. That said, the other part of this is that I think that there is, as you said, there is a little bit of, we have our blinders on until we don't. We're not looking for this kind of information until we really need it. Mm-hmm. And then when we do need it, then we say, oh, there's a whole world out here that I haven't been paying attention to. So I do think that there is a little bit of, if you're not dealing with any sort of chronic pain, then why would you even pay attention to this?
Yeah.
Why would you seek this out? Until you are and you're trying to get relief from it, then there's kind of this awareness to it. But even then, it usually takes a while for people to get there. But yep. Yeah, it has changed dramatically, Eddie. You've seen it in 7 years or six, 7 years since you've been doing this podcast, which is amazing. I tell my whole team that I work with, like, I think the next 10 years are just going to be, and I mean this in the best possible way, are just going to be bananas, because like there's so much more information out there. There's so much more research. Like even the research is coming out faster and faster and faster, which is just amazing. So I'm super excited.
Yeah. So that's interesting too. And this is just more of a yes, no question, but the first time that I interviewed Christy was before the Boulder back pain study was even done. It was still being worked on. And so were you involved in that project at all?
Yes, the short answer is yes. It kept getting, the speed of research is very slow. And so it kept getting pushed back. And I, at the time, was also working as the head of a counseling program at a college in Los Angeles. And I needed to be there. So I kind of was part of the preliminary setup for that study, and then I backed out, so I didn't actually have to fly back and forth to Colorado to do the therapy work. But I was there with them in spirit as they did it.
It's funny you say the fly back and forth thing, because when Christy was in the midst of doing that, she had talked about a fear of flying, and that she was having like the exposure therapy to the 5 millionth degree by going through that.
Yeah, she and I would talk about that on the phone. She was having to fly back like two or three times a week.
One of the other things that I've thought quite a bit about, and I don't even know like the best way to ask this, but there's sort of like, because most people, well, all people that listen to this podcast have an awareness of. Either they're like, for instance, there's a Facebook group that's dedicated to this podcast, meaning you're somebody that's heard of it and you've listened to it and you have suggestions for the show or ideas or questions, and then they can put those down and, they might be asked to somebody that's a guest or things like that. So these people are aware. Nobody ever stumbles on this podcast that has no inkling of what Dr. Sarno is or what, mind body therapy is or things like that. They all know it. But one of the
great community you've built.
Yeah, for sure. And people all over the world and all, all different countries. It seems like this is sort of a universal language, which I think is certainly a good thing. But one of the things that I've like thought about is ulcers were this thing in the 70s and 80s. Mm-hmm. And then we sort of just get on, like, for instance, I did a lot of competitive CrossFit in 2013, 14, 15. And there was a time where, I don't think this is the case anymore, but basically 90% of the people that did competitive CrossFit somehow developed a quote celiac allergy or celiac disease. Everybody was afraid of gluten. That was a thing.
Yes.
It was collective conscious. And to me, it's very much the same thing as the back pain that Sarno wrote so much about.
Yes. 100%.
In the post COVID world, so let's say the past 3 to 4 years, are there other themes of, and it doesn't have to just be physical symptoms, though those would be great if you have any of those, but what are some examples of this kind of collective conscious idea of new things that weren't a thing 10 years ago or weren't as much of a thing 10 years ago that you see?
Eddie, I love this question because we see this all the time. And that's like one of the joys I really have. One of the joys I have being in this field for a little while now. And I hope I continue to see this the longer I'm in this, that I'm seeing fads, and I was told about them early on and I didn't. And I expected that, but it's so interesting to watch. I get so many fewer fibromyalgia referrals now than I did 10 years ago.
Wow.
And not that people don't get diagnosed with fibromyalgia, but significantly fewer than used to. These days, I get a ton of EDS, which is Ehlers-Danlos syndrome.
Oh, okay. I haven't even heard of that. Talk about it.
Yeah, it's a joint connectivity. Wow, I cannot talk today. A tissue connectivity disorder.
Okay.
Sorry, as I said, I had to move to my parents' house because my internet died in my house and my brain's a little fried.
Yeah, that's okay.
Basically, there is a genetic test to prove whether or not you have EDS, but a lot of people are diagnosed with EDS without the genetic test.
Okay.
It's a little bit like what you're talking about in terms of gluten sensitivity. We can test to see if somebody has celiac. And if they do, great, then there are ways to limit, of course, gluten intake. But for a lot of people, they're said, oh, you probably have celiac, just limit gluten. And that's not always accurate. We get so many people diagnosed with EDS right now. And there are certain cities, Portland being one of them, where there are a few doctors that basically somebody comes in, they talk about joint pain, and they diagnose them with EDS. I'm exaggerating a little bit here, but the number that we've seen within the last 3 years is crazy compared to what it used to be. And we get referrals from all over the world, too, so this isn't just based on the sample in Portland.
Sure.
But EDS is one, and there was just one other I was just talking about with my clinicians. It'll come to me in a second. But you're spot on here. We do see these fads and these trends, and everyone is likely to partake in those trends. I include myself in that. We kind of partake in this, okay, this is the treatment for this specific thing, or this is the diagnosis du jour, and we just kind of get our minds on it, and we end up talking about it or diagnosing people with it more often than not. We do this in the psych world with, you know, everybody talks about borderline personality disorder right now, which is a personality disorder that does exist. Does it exist as commonly as therapists talk about it? I don't believe so, because we are likely to, you know, there's a recency bias there. So if we've talked about something recently, then we're going to think about it more. We're going to think about it more and going to diagnose somebody with it. This is just, it's a great question. And I'm always kind of being conscious of the diagnoses that we're seeing in people and to see if they're over-diagnosing. I don't actually think people get diagnosed with fibro as much anymore because I think they get diagnosed with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Okay. Interesting.
Because they present very similarly. As I said, it's like joint and tissue connectivity. So there's a certain, if people are complaining about pain in their hands, their feet, their knees, or hypermobility because of the joint connectivity, which is how they used to look at fibromyalgia and how they used to diagnose that, was being like, okay, do you have, you know, general pain in your joints? They would say, okay, then this is fibro. There's no test for fibro. And that's kind of what's happening with EDS.
Yeah.
I'm rambling here, but you get the point.
No. I definitely get it. I would assume that the treatment of people with that is the same as if somebody came to you with a simple back pain or a simple, you know, like kind of all the, like a lot of the other physical
disorders,
or is this any different?
No, it's exactly the same. Now, again, if they've gone through the genetic testing for it, there's still work that can be done for sure, because our mind obviously always influences the way that we feel in our body. Mm-hmm. But if they've gone through the genetic testing to demonstrate that they do have EDS, then that changes things a bit. But yeah, otherwise we treat it exactly the same way. And you'll find that with people with EDS, again, it's mostly women get diagnosed with it right now. But they present the same way as all kind of TMS mind-body symptoms do, is that there's an irregularity to the way that they present. There's inconsistencies. The pain fluctuates. The symptoms fluctuate. So we treat it exactly the same way.
What do you feel like is the, you know, say you get a, and maybe it doesn't work this way, but say that you get a referral for somebody who very much with the fiber of their being believes that this is a physical thing that I've got going on. Like, what's your, you know, you're a superhero. What's your plan of... what's your plan of attack? How do you go about treating them? Is it like, because you need them to buy in, but like, How do you go about it? And again, this is just a very basic rubric, and you know, feel free to spend as little or as much time as you want on this. But I'm always curious about that because this seems like one of the fields that is out there where it's, I mean, the term prescription is very medical, but it does, it seems like this would be very hard to have a, you know, you probably don't have a flip chart that says, here's exactly how you treat somebody that has, you know, mind body thing going on. It's probably not prescriptive. It's probably very individual. So how do you go about, you get somebody new in your office, they come to your office, they have these, they have this issue going on. How do you go about it? How do you decide how to go about it?
It's such a good question. And if you have a three-step process that you know of that works 100% of the time, please let me know.
I don't.
It's, you know, what you're talking about is essentially how to change someone's mind once they've made their mind up. And that is a difficult process that you, that people are, it's a difficult process that therapists are trying to do regardless if we're talking about pain or not. My goal, and this is what I train all my clinicians on here, our goal is not to change people's mind or force a perspective here. Our goal is to present information that enables somebody to change their mind if they want to. And usually that involves gathering information, gathering evidence about how our body behaves, how our symptoms behave, and how our mind might be influencing that. So if somebody comes to me and they're like, hey, I'm 100% positive that my back pain is because of this disc bulge. Well, first, it's probably rare that they're going to be coming to me because I know I'm not a surgeon. But if it's not uncommon. People still do that. Then I'll say, okay, great. Let's operate under that premise here. Let's operate under the premise that this disc bulge or this, you know, 3-millimeter disc herniation is why you have back pain. Then we'll talk through the various ways that that behaves. Okay, so you have back pain that shows up, you know, sometimes during the day or a couple times during the week, but not other times. Why is that? Let's unpack that. Let's figure that out. Let's see what's going on psychologically while that's happening. And sometimes people will say, well, nothing's going on psychologically. There's no changes there, which either demonstrates one of two things. One, they're right. Or two, they don't know. Yeah. They're not necessarily insightful as to what's going on. And that's okay. A lot of us don't have the insight to know what's going on in our minds all the time. That's just human behavior. You know, I'm going through this right now on my own. I'm kind of going through a stressful period in my life. And my knee has been acting up, which was an old TMS symptom of mine. And my brain, a couple of weeks ago, I was at the gym and my brain automatically went to, oh crap, what did I do to my knee? I screwed it up. I was doing squats or something and I like must have squat too much. And now my knee's busted. Now, the next day I went back on a backpacking trip and my knee didn't hurt the entire time, which doesn't make any sense. My knee, I was actually lifting more of that damn backpack than I was at the gym. So it doesn't make any sense. So I had to kind of talk myself through that process of saying, okay, what's going on? And I had to remind myself, oh yeah, this is a stressful time in my life. I have a lot going on. Chances are these symptoms here, they're not because of my knee, any sort of structural problem. It's a neuroplasticity issue. And this is, you know, and I'll level with people and say those kinds of things to my clients. Like, hey, this is, we all go through this. It's not our job to make a judgment about what's going on without gathering information. It's our job to gather information and have the information lead us to an answer here. Sometimes we're just really bad at making those judgments on our own, without looking at the information.
Maybe a difficult question to answer because it's probably not linear the way that you would do this or think about this. But I mean, how much of the initial, I don't know, let's say initial month that you're working with somebody, let's say you do 3 or 4 sessions with somebody. How much of that time is dedicated towards getting them? I'm imagining, let's say it's in office. I know you do a lot. I'm sure you do a lot virtually, but let's say it's in an office. And I'm imagining this empty room and you're sitting 3 feet apart and you're trying to, you know, you're giving them the evidence. You're trying to convince them. How long over a period of maybe a month or 3 or 4 sessions or however we can define this, how much of that time is spent just simply getting them to sort of turn the corner and believe, yeah, this could definitely, you could definitely be on the right track. Maybe it's not physical.
Yeah.
For most people.
For the average person, obviously there are kind of what we'd say like more highly defended people, which means it takes a lot longer. For the average person, you know, you can get somebody kind of on board and having an understanding within a few weeks, especially if they do some homework or do some reading. Mm-hmm. That said, sometimes it's actually really not worth the effort from the therapist perspective to try and convince or try and gather evidence for anything. And let me put it this way. I know absolutely nothing about cars. I think my dad tried to teach me when I was a kid and I just was not interested. So I know nothing about how cars work. Some people love to know exactly how they work. I don't want someone to, if my car breaks, I don't want someone to necessarily teach me how the car works. I just want them to fix it.
Yep.
And so sometimes if I go to the mechanic, like they might tell me a whole bunch of stuff, but I don't actually want to know that. I just want to say like, hey, will I be able to drive to the grocery store or whatever? And sometimes people come to therapy that way. They're like, I actually don't need to get on board. I don't need to know any of this stuff for sure. Can you just show me ways to get better? Now, it's easier if they're on board and understand that this is a mind-body issue, but there are ways to circumvent that as well. Especially if we talk about like emotional awareness and expression therapy, if we get them to a place where they can potentially feel the feelings or understand what's going on emotionally underneath that pain, then we don't need them to buy in 100% because the pain will just kind of start to dissipate and disappear mm-hmm. over time. So it just kind of depends. That's why you say like, this is a very individualized thing. I always tell people it's therapy. It's not a class. If it were as easy as taking a class, everybody would do it. It'd be a lot cheaper and easier.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But this is individualized because everybody shows up with their own stuff. And we, as a therapist, we're constantly trying to be like, okay, how do we navigate through this stuff to get them the best possible outcome?
Are there certain either like personality types or professions that seem more resistant to being, we'll just say enlightenment. That sounds a little, sounds a little lame, but are more resistant to that than others. Like what are maybe a couple of personality traits that you have identified in your experience that they just have a tougher time buying into this being legitimate?
Well, ironically, Eddie, it's people that develop chronic pain have the personality types to be less likely to buy into this.
Yep.
Because we tend to be very analytical, kind of thinking people versus feeling people.
Mm-hmm.
So trying to think things through rationally becomes very difficult to understand when this is actually a problem that we want to feel our way out of, not think our way out of.
Yep.
Which sounds kind of woo-woo and out there, I get it. But it is true. We want to be able to emotionally express things, not think about them. And those are very different processes. You know, it's funny, when I started this work, I grew up in Portland, which is, you know, kind of a hippie town. And I would tell some of my friends about it and be like, yeah, of course, that makes perfect sense. And they would have no resistance to it whatsoever. And then I tell, you know, people that I went to grad school with, or even my family, we're a family of a lot of thinkers. And they'd be like, huh, this is weird. I don't know if I buy into this.
Yeah.
You know, so those of us that develop chronic pain, we tend to be the most resistant to actually being on board to understanding that. And that's just part of the process. If we weren't resistant to it, we'd be more open to the feelings that are coming up. We wouldn't be as resistant to that, and there wouldn't be a need for pain.
Does that transcend, in your experience, cultures worldwide? Like, are there certain parts of the world Ooh. where you work with a client and they're more accepting, and maybe it's because of the part of the world that they're in, or just the you know, the cultural significance of where they're from? Is there anything that comes to mind?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I feel so lucky. I've worked with people pretty much all over the world, just, you know, by the nature of working online. I would say Western Europeans tend to be a bit more open than Americans.
Okay.
They tend to be a little bit less resistant. I worked with a couple of people in India that wrote some very nice things about me online. So it meant that I ended up getting a lot more Indian referrals. And I would say India is kind of on par with the States in terms of the level of resistance, kind of a more resistant space.
Okay.
I'm trying to think of where else.
I've interviewed a couple of like Aussie, New Zealand people here on this podcast as well.
Yeah, the Kiwis tend to be pretty open. That has been my experience. Mm-hmm. I think I've probably only worked with a couple dozen Kiwis over the years, but tend to be pretty open. Aussies, I tend to kind of I have to think about how many people from Australia I've worked with, but I kind of see it on par with the States in terms of level of resistance. But, you know, I'm also speaking from a relatively small sample size. I only see, you know, 30 people per week or less than that these days. Over 10 plus years, you imagine I'm not seeing 30,000 people. My sample size is small.
I mean, maybe relative, but if I said 30 people a week, let's just say 49 weeks a year for 10 years, yeah. That's a lot of people. That's a lot
fair.
Of people.
That's fair. I'm just a scientist at heart, yeah. So I want to be mindful of my own biases.
I mean, here's the stupid thing about the internet is I can go on Twitter or X or whatever we want to call it, and the definitive
that's what it's called now.
Yeah, the yeah. definitive answer is what one person. Yes. saw on a meme on Facebook 3 years yeah. ago. You know what I mean? So,
which is why I tell all of my clients to get off the internet.
Yeah, get off the internet. Okay. Here's something that I know we only got a few minutes left, but I want to get some of your take on.
Sure.
I've had this conversation recently with a couple of people that I've interviewed where there was a guy in particular a couple of weeks ago where he was speaking about, what's the best way to put this? He was talking about basically people that have big T traumas that he doesn't necessarily know anything about, but like could be the death of a parent or the death of a loved one or something like that. They're in a significant car accident, something along those lines. Uh-huh. And then him being like, well, I can't really think that my issues are a mind-body problem because I just haven't had anything, you know, bad happen to me. And then I sort of stopped him and said, we can't really diminish our own experience though either.
Yes,
because
right.
Just because something doesn't seem like a big T to you, there's still a cumulative portion of this. And just because, like, for instance, like one of the most, this sounds so stupid saying this all these years later, in 1993 or four, I can't remember what year it was, I had worked very hard selling wrapping paper for my school's fundraiser. And
amazing.
Out of that, yeah, and out of that, I got a, and again, I'm in third or fourth grade, I got a digital organizer. That was what I earned. And I was so pumped. And there's not a lot I can put in there, right? But it's a little digital organizer and it's mine and I earned it. I brought it to school one day and I put it in my cubby during recess and I came back and it was gone. I never saw it after that. That's still, I'm 30.
That's devastating.
I'm going to be 38 in March. That's still one of the things that I remember as like a just awful event from my childhood. And it sounds crazy talking about it now.
No, but trauma is subjective.
Right. Trauma is subjective. And so
yes.
I would love for you to just give your take on, there's a lot of talk of like big T traumas, I feel like in kind of this community. And, you know, I can get on board with that stuff, but I feel like yep. in a lot of ways that doesn't identify the chronic pain epidemic either. So
for
talk
sure.
about that. When I just bring that up, tell me what comes to mind.
Well, there's a, as I just said, though, trauma is subjective. We can kind of classify things as like big T or little T trauma, but everything we go through can be subjective, especially based on different personality mm-hmm. types. We're all kind of born with a certain kind of parts of our personality are already set in play when we're born. And those of us that tend to be perfectionists, tend to be intellectual, we tend to be more sensitive, or these things get those traumas kind of affect us more profoundly.
Yep.
That's not a bad thing. That's just who we are. That's fine. So what comes to mind here is that, you know, what I would call that the person you had on the podcast, and I don't know them, but it sounds like what they were doing is like what we would call the defensive rationalization or the defensive intellectualization, meaning they weren't allowing themselves to feel the feelings about that particular trauma or whatever various small T traumas they've had. They were thinking through it and saying, you know what, my traumas are not as big as somebody else's, so my feelings don't matter.
Mm-hmm.
So, or my feelings shouldn't, I shouldn't have feelings about this. And it turns out if we tell ourselves that often enough, we end up not feeling those things because we repress the feelings.
Yeah.
So we always want to, in the therapy world, we're always pointing out when somebody might be intellectualizing or rationalizing a feeling away. It's easy to say, oh, it was just about wrapping paper and I was just a kid and it was just a little electronic organizer. How could I be upset about that? It's easy to think that through. But, you know, the parts of our brain that process feelings and our thoughts are very different.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like one part of your brain yelling at the other, being like, shut up, don't say anything. When that part of your brain, the emotional part's like, hey, but I'm still hurt, even though you think that this isn't a big deal.
Yep.
You yeah. know, it's the same thing as I always tell people to externalize. So externalize the thoughts we have in our head as though we're having a conversation with somebody else. So Eddie, if you came to me and you were like, oh, I was hurt by this. And I said, shut up, who cares about that? Well, that wouldn't make you feel very good.
No, wouldn't.
First of all, I'd be a terrible therapist.
Yeah. Don't say that to anybody that talks to you, by the way. Don't do that.
Yeah. Oh, good advice. Thank you. But yeah, that's what's happening internally. You know, if we have that conversation with ourselves about our whatever traumas we may experience, if we say to ourselves, oh no, I shouldn't allow myself to feel that way, we're basically just saying shut up to ourselves, which is just not very kind.
The other thing that I would like to get, now this is almost sounds counter to it, but one thing that I think about, and I did like a solo me up on a soapbox for 10 minutes talking about this on the episode last week, but sort of the nucleus of it was one thing that going through all the amount of pain that I had for the amount of time that I had it, and then having as many, by the time this airs, this will probably be episode like 298 or 300 or something like that. So I've had a lot of conversations in this field, and most of those are about
an hour. That's why you have that honorary doctorate.
Yeah, that's why I have the honorary doctorate. But a lot of sort of my thought as it's come over time has also just been, and maybe it's just me getting older, but is just a change in perspective, meaning that things that maybe made me feel a certain way 10 years ago, if that same thing happened to me today, it could be difference of age. It could be difference in perspective. It could be, hey, like me wrestling with this in my mind and replaying the situation over and over again really didn't serve me well. And it brought me a lot of physical pain and a lot of physical ailments. And so can you just talk about, I guess, the nature of how do we, those things seem like they're in conflict with each other. How can I reconcile small T traumas or just daily life things that get to me, and also just having perspective that, hey, in 3 years, I'm probably not even going to remember this thing, you know, this thing that's going on. Does that make sense at all?
Yeah, both things can be true. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong here, what I think you're talking about ultimately is like building resiliency.
Yes, 1,000%.
Yeah, and we see this a lot, and resiliency is not something you can fast forward is part of the problem.
Yeah.
And actually, we don't get more resilient by repressing or suppressing our feelings. We get resilient by allowing ourselves to feel those feelings and moving on from them and continuing to challenge ourselves. So saying, you know, trying to minimize whatever trauma we experienced right now by saying, in 3 years, this will be no big deal, that doesn't move us past that trauma.
Yeah.
What does is saying like, hey, this was really hurtful for me. This was a traumatic experience. Talking to somebody about it, journaling about it, et cetera, sitting with the sadness or the grief or whatever comes up, or the anger, and then moving on and challenging ourselves to potentially expose ourselves to a similar circumstance again, where we might get hurt or we might, you know, succeed in whatever we were trying to do. But resiliency is built not through fast forwarding and trying not to feel. Resilience is built through feeling the pain of these things, which is tough.
Yes. Well, that leads to maybe a tough question too, because there is so much nuance in how I try to explain it. When you say feel the feelings, what does that mean? How do you teach somebody what that is? Because for the longest time, and it wasn't until I really just deconstructed the word of what feel hyphen ing is, did I understand it. But can you break it down a little bit?
I always tell people they're called feelings, not thinkings.
Yeah.
Because they are literally physical sensations in the body. Now, they may be very subtle, but they are physical sensations in the body.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of therapists, and these are a lot of somatic therapists, not even just in the pain world, but will be constantly trying to help their patients, their clients, get more in touch with the subtle feelings that are happening in their body. Subtle sensations, we'll call them that. And that is a way to understand what we are feeling so that we can then be informed by that and make choices that make us feel better. It sounds kind of like cheesy. And when I first started this work, I would kind of roll my eyes at like, feel the feelings. But ultimately that's what we're trying to get people to do for their health. To get to your point about how to do that. The first thing I tell people is we really want to get like out of your head and into your body. So most people try and think their way through these situations. And I can't tell you how many times I ask somebody like, how are you feeling about this? Or what are you feeling towards this person? And they will respond with, well, I think, and already we're on the wrong track.
Yeah.
Because they're using their brain to answer a problem or answer a question that is somatic based, that is based on their body. You know, if you did a really intense workout and I asked you, how do you feel after that workout? And you said, oh, I think I did 50 push-ups. It's like, well, that doesn't actually give me any information about the way your body feels right now. You could be more specific and be like, well, there's tension here because I, you know, did push-ups, so there's tension in my chest, or I'm out of breath, or those kinds of things. Now, that may sound small, but that's just those are training wheels for understanding those sensations in our body and how they can inform what we do. You know, using that example of working out, if you were to just completely ignore that you were out of breath and you were sore after doing a really intense CrossFit workout, for example, then you may not think you need to eat afterwards or sit down for a bit. And you might end up pushing yourself too hard. But if you're tuned into the sensations in your body, you're going to say, oh, okay, actually, I pushed myself really hard. I need to drink water. I need to sit down for a bit. I need to eat something to kind of give me more fuel to keep going in my day.
Mm-hmm.
Feelings are the same way. They're a bit more subtle. So after we have a conversation with somebody, it's a bit like a workout. We may walk away from that being like, hey, there are some sensations in my body. Let me see if I can interpret them. Maybe my heart's racing. Maybe my stomach is in knots. Maybe because I'm angry with this person. Maybe that's what those feelings are.
So with that, because truly more than any tool in my toolkit, that getting in tune and somatic tracking has been more valuable than anything.
And
actually it came from, I can't remember if it was part one or part two, but in the TMS Wiki, Alan Gordon did that like 24 day or 21 day or whatever it is, the program. And he had a video in there and he was talking about a sensation in the chest. And that's what I started doing was like, I may not be feeling anything in this moment. Like a good trigger for me and the way that I know, hey, like something's up that you need to be, the, like do some inner work. And usually that means somatic tracking of some kind. But anytime that I find myself deliberating over two things for very long, and I'll give you an example, is that this was a couple of years, this came up when I was interviewing Christy, actually, a couple of years ago.
Okay.
I was debating between two, this, it's unrelated completely. I was debating between two motorcycles, and it was just endless research, and I could not make a decision, just could not make a
decision.
Analysis
paralysis.
Yeah. Right. Anytime that I get into that, and it doesn't matter what the thing is, it could be about that. It could be about what formation am I going to, do I want to run for my U10 girls on Saturday at their game? If I find myself having an inner conflict over anything and I jump back and forth constantly, I know there is something up and you got to stop for just a second. And so that's when I sit there and then I will just visualize that place in my chest that Alan suggested. And it might take 30 seconds or it might take 2 minutes or it might take 5 seconds, but I start to feel something. And the best way I can describe it is just a swirling sensation. That's what I feel like a very, you're in the desert and you're looking out at tumbleweeds rolling around. And then you start to see some of those dust devils or whatever that are moving up.
Yeah.
And sometimes it'll get faster and it'll get stronger. And then after 2 or 3 minutes, the swell is gone. And I can feel my heart rate just plummet like suddenly.
Yeah.
And what my question would be for you
Amazing. Is
if somebody's getting in tune with themselves on that level, is the thought is your advice, is it to, hey, at the same time that you're grasping this feeling, you're feeling it, should you also then be thinking about things that could be bugging you or could be the root of it? Or is it literally just sit there and be with it?
To start with, it would be just sit there and be with it.
Mm-hmm.
Really just be present to your body. It sounds so simple, but most of the time people are detached from their bodies. They're not really paying attention to what's going on physically.
Yeah.
They're just in their head about things. And so constantly challenging yourself to be in your body and pay attention to what those sensations are and then trying to redirect them or calm them or whatever you can do. That's really the foundation of a lot of somatic work, not just in the pain world. That's just the foundation of so much somatic work. I'm a Vipassana meditator. I've done a lot of a few 10-day silent meditation retreats where you just sit there for 10 hours and meditate. And it's its own kind of hell. But those days, those 10-hour days of meditating are really, truly just about sitting with whatever sensation shows up in your body and learning to sit with it, be okay with it, and breathe through it. And that's a brutal training ground that I wouldn't recommend people do unless they really want to. But that's the essence of all somatic work from various schools of thought, because that comes from even a Buddhist school of thought.
Yeah. Have you, this is off topic because we're about to wrap, but have you, I don't know if you're a podcast listener at all, but or a YouTube watcher, there's a really great doctor that a lot of his stuff in the last 2 years has shifted to a lot more of this mind body stuff. And he's been a hospitalist at Stanford. He's an internal medicine doctor. It's Dr. Zubin, but he goes by Z Dog MD. Have you ever heard that name?
Yes, I have heard the name. I actually haven't heard his podcast, but I have heard of him.
So his podcast is great, but he does a lot of these 10-day silent meditation things. I'd say, I don't know, 4 times a year, he probably goes and does them.
Amazing.
And I feel like you'd get a kick out of him if,
and
listen to it.
I'm going to listen to him.
It's very interesting hearing the perspective of, I'm not saying, again, this is like part of the white coat syndrome thing, but I'm not saying that doctors are any more enlightened or awakened than just Joe Schmo, me and my wife. Right. But like, but I have had a lot of weird experiences with doctors over the years, and he seems like a really different breed because of a lot of stuff that he isn't like, he has this, and you may have heard of her. She recently actually came out with a mind body pain workbook, but Dr. Rachel Zofnis, Yeah, so he has her on quite a bit, and this is the stuff that they talk about. They've never once mentioned Sarno or Schubiner or Gordon or any of this, but like it is the same. Again, we're all saying the same things, just we're using different words.
100%.
So, yeah. Okay, you got a website. People, you know, let's say somebody's listening to this somewhere and they love what Dan Lyman is about. And where can they find you more out about you?
My company name, my organization is called the Mind Body Therapy Center. You can go on mindbodytherapycenter.org. That's the easiest way to check our information out. Also, I'm always happy to respond to emails. I spend a lot of my week responding to emails from the pain reprocessing therapy trainings or from just random people that reach out. My email address is daniel@mindbodytherapycenter.org. So feel free and shoot me an email too. Happy to respond.
Awesome. I feel like I could do this with you forever. So with that in mind, let's keep in touch. But thank you for being here.
Definitely. Oh, I'm honored to be here. Thank you so much, Eddie. And keep up the good work. I'm very impressed by all the work you've been doing over the years. And again, happy 6-year anniversary.
It's incredible. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks. This is Daniel Lyman. Thank you for being here.
Of course. Have a good one, Eddie.